Good evening. James McCanney here with my Science Hour, August 16th, 2012. And thank you for listening. As always, this show brought to you commercial-free and one of the few shows, I believe, in the world, in the planet, that comes to you without sponsors, without commercials. So at any rate, tonight's main science topic, I'm going to be talking about the anatomy of hurricanes, a little bit on El Nino in the Pacific. How are these things related? I'm going to be talking about Hale-Bopp, adding some more information. I've been talking about that lately. And an interesting twist that it was captured at what I estimate is the same time as Venus had to have been captured into the solar system. And that was around 4,200 years ago. In the back, in the appendix of one of my papers, I call it the three-part comet paper, there's a calculation that I did. And this was back in 1979 when I was first starting to work with planetary dynamics and the data that was coming in from spacecraft dealing with comets and the fact that big comets could become planets. Not all comets become planets. Obviously, there's many little comets. But the point is that a big comet can have its orbit altered very radically because of the tail drag. It's pulling in a lot of material in the plasma discharge comet model. It's pulling in a lot of material with electrical forces, ions, dust, rocks, using also the induced electric dipole force for small pebbles and dust that have metals in them. And so at any rate, the drag that is put on the nucleus pulls on this material and it pulls back. So it's pulling back on material that causes the nucleus to change its orbit. It's like millions and millions of tiny collisions, and that's one way to look at it. But at any rate, it allows the comet to slowly, there are two effects. One is that the elliptical orbit becomes less elliptical and it loses energy, so it's steadily falling inwards on its orbit as it circles the sun. The other thing that it can do is it circularizes the orbit. There's another effect that I should throw in here before I forget about it. And that is something that our Earth is being pulled into a different plane. We think of Earth's orbit around the sun as the ecliptic. And Earth actually has its orbit changing a little bit. And here's what happens. If it's below the orbit of Jupiter or the other planets, they pull up on it slightly. And if on the other part of its orbit, if Earth is above the orbit of the other planets, they pull down on it. So the planets are always working towards a point of equilibrium, a plane of equilibrium. And so the end result is that the orbit of Earth is always adjusting a little bit. And this happens with comets also. If many comets come in, they're not perfectly in the plane of the planets. Their orbits lie askew. And so when they are up above the plane of the planets, all the planets are pulling down on them. And when they go around to the other side of their orbit and they get below the other planets, then all the planets are pulling up on them. So on this object. So in other words, that is constantly working to pull it into the plane of the planets. And of course, these objects can come in at any time. But the point is that it's a way of building a solar system. It's a construction method, and we can expect new members at any time. It could happen any day, and that's what we call Planet X. But when you look up in the sky, you're not going to see a big ball, or you're not going to see a dot or anything like that. And by the way, there's a bunch of real nutcases running around the internet. There's lots and lots of them saying that they've seen Planet X, or here's a companion to Planet X. I've seen all this garbage. Don't believe any of it, because there are pages and pages that show objects like circulars. One I saw was clearly the planet Venus, and they were pawning it off as a companion to Planet X. But at any rate, the point is that if you see an object in the sky that if you see a big object in the sky, potentially a Planet X type object that's planet size, you're not going to see the object, you're going to see a large comet. And herein lies the ruse, the lie. One of the biggest lies of NASA, and yes, NASA lies all the time. They cover up data, they smudge it, they twist it, they tweak it, and it's all to protect their dirty snowball comet model, the concept that they propose that all the planets formed at one time billions of years ago and nothing has happened since. It's pretty comical when they discovered over 40 new planets and they had to demote Pluto as a planet from being a planet since the time we were kids. Pluto was a planet. Now all of a sudden it's not. Well, why isn't it? Because if Pluto were a planet, they have 40 planets that are bigger than Pluto. So now all of a sudden, bingo, we'd have 49 planets, not nine. And that would raise a lot of questions in people's minds. The average person would go, hey, well, why not more? All of a sudden we have 40 more, not why 400 more? And NASA has publicly, but on the back page, kind of in the fine print, admitted that they've only discovered what they think is about 1% of all of the planetary objects out there. When they're way out there, like Sedna or some of the other planets that are out there, or they call them Kuiper belt objects, they will look like a planet. They will be round. But if those, any of them or any like them ever came into the solar system up to about the point of Saturn, the orbit of Saturn, they would turn into comets. They would discharge the solar capacitor, start picking up matter. And getting back to Hale-Bopp, its encounter with the solar system about 4,200 years ago it came by Jupiter. And so I'm thinking here's what happened, because the ancients talk about multiple comets in the sky at the same time. So, for example, Velikovsky concentrates on the piece that became the comet Venus that eventually became the planet Venus. That was captured by Jupiter. Velikovsky's story, of course, was wrong. That it was spit out of Jupiter. That he didn't understand a lot of the science here. So scientists ridicule him on some of these points. And when I've been on debates on national radio or I've clarified these topics, I point out the errors that Velikovsky made. But basically, he was trying to use scientific theory that was available in 1950. And, of course, he came out with some convoluted, mixed-up concepts. But he didn't really understand this idea of capture. So the idea that capture is a process by where chunks, big chunks, can be small chunks, big chunks of matter come in the form of an asteroid or a small planet-sized object, are captured into the solar system and then become large comets. I'll be talking a little bit about that. But I was saying that NASA lies. One of the biggest perpetrated lies regarding NASA is that they lie about the size of nuclei, comet nuclei. They all have to be these little teeny puffballs that can't do anything. And that's the division, that's the garbage tier two science that's pawned off on the public. And lots of NASA Trekkies out there buying this hook, line, and sinker. But obviously, there are so many counterexamples. That great one just this past summer, Comet Lovejoy, swinging around the sun, going through the solar atmosphere in the corona, which is even hotter, and then coming out the other side as a visible planet. It was big. I mean, this was a big object. Could have been the size of Jupiter. Could have been the size of Earth, or certainly very big, but visible right next to the sun in the morning sky. The raw planet right there before it started to regain a tail. And of course, the standard story out of NASA, or its apologists, I should say, NASA never says anything. They have their little fleet of apologists out there, that was 200 meters across, the 600 foot diameter, and that's a whopping big one for them, immensely big. No, these objects are planet size, big. And so, anyway, the point is that Hale-Bopp had a nucleus that was definitely planet-sized, and when they're that big, when the comet tail material is drawn in, they have sufficient surface gravity to hold that material in place and start building up the atmosphere, building up the mass, the matter in the planetary core. So at any rate, the point is that I believe that Venus and Hale-Bopp came in at the same time as large comets. I'm going to quick divert for a couple of announcements here. The international corporations are added again in Chile, Argentina, and Colombia in Latin America, putting up water dams where they're absconding with the land of the indigenous people in these areas. Typically, these are out in remote areas where the people are campesinos. They're poor people. You know, they live out there and their families have lived out there forever. And they're, first of all, they're not going to be compensated by these companies. They're simply being given the right to go in there, and police go in and beat the local people. These stories, of course, never hit the national news or even local news here in the good old United States. Multinational corporations are absconding with the water rights and land and mineral rights. I should say, when these corporations go in there, the idea is to build a dam, and they sell it to the public as being a great success in modernization with electricity for all. But it's all about the water and the mineral rights. And when they get done, they tell people, you cannot take these are the indigenous people that they threw off the land. They tell them, you cannot take a glass of water out of this reservoir that's behind the dam, or you will be arrested and thrown in jail. That's what they tell people. So this is a water grab. It's going on around the world. The entire world water supply is under control, and international corporations are given the right to go in, take over. They can call up the government to get the police goons to come in and mess up the basically beat the local people into submission. And walk off with the water rights. Many of these areas have oil, gold, other minerals, and so they can first build the dam and then underneath go under and build mines to get out the natural resources, all for free. And the people, the local people, don't get a dime or a bolivar, they don't get a nickel out of any of this. So just wanted to let people know about this. I've talked about these issues before on my show. And we don't have a water shortage. We don't have a water problem on this planet. We have a water management problem. And as with anything that involves multinational corporations and collusion with governments, is that that's simply what it is. It's big business rolling roughshod over the local people, taking what they want and controlling. And then what more basic right could there possibly be on this planet than the right to clean, fresh water? It falls from the sky. Why is it being controlled and monopolized by groups? You can say that also for oil. That oil really comes from comet tails, and it rains in, and that's where the earth oil comes from. It doesn't just magically appear under the ground one day, and it wasn't made from fossil fern forests or dinosaur bones. So where does the oil come from? Enough for millions and millions all over the world, billions of people to drive automobiles around every day. where did that all come from? It's on a world scale. And if you think that fern forests caused that by their decay, then you belong, I guess, where you are right now, in a fog. But the point is, the reason I'm trying to announce this, bring awareness to the fact that in these areas, local people are attempting to fight the government entities, the police goons, and multinational corporations who are invisible. Who do you fight? These people are trying to block roads and sit on their land that they've owned for centuries and centuries, where their families have lived there, and they don't even know who they're fighting. I was talking with a friend of mine the other day, and I said, you know, a thief on the street that comes up to you with a knife and puts a knife in your stomach and says, give me your money, at least I would call him an honest thief. They're out in the open. There's no question about what they're stealing from you, and they want what you've got. And, you know, I would call them, compared to the government, the multinationals that you can't see, you don't know where they are, you don't know where their offices are. There's no, you have no idea where these people are. They come in and their engineering crews have access to go in and measure what minerals are there. That information is fed back to a corporate center. Decisions are made in a boardroom in some foreign country. And then after all is said and done, those rights can be sold in a second to another corporation. Another multinational picks up the rights. And so you are fighting company A over here, and now all of a sudden you don't even know it, and it's being owned or controlled by another company. And these are just front entities for the World Banking, the IMF, and all of the people that hover around the central banks and the governments of the world to basically suck the resources out of the world and monopolize and use the people for slave labor. This is the state of the world today. But the issue with water is something that is critical. Every person on this planet needs fresh water. Ownership of water should have been illegal. How could anybody ever assume that someone would own water, or there would be laws passed to prevent people from collecting water? I've seen many articles recently where people were collecting water and were arrested because they had a water tank or something outside of their house, or a water catchment basin, that is illegal. What on earth is going on this planet? And I got to say that the only redeeming possibility to change all of this and somehow get it back to normal, whatever that is, I guess get us back to the cave ages at least, where at least you could law the jungle and you could throw rocks at people, that the only solution is Planet X. That the corporations, as I say, you don't even know who they are or where they are. How do you fight them? There's no court that reigns above them. They corporate greed and profit and earning, chasing the dollar is the only thing that matters to them. And the rights of people and the well-being of people is just stomp on people, walk and stomp them into the dirt, and that they go home and eat a big steak and go to sleep at night. These are the people that are operating the world. The rich bankers need a lot of greedy people to make the whole system work correctly. So as a result of this, all I can say is try to become aware of these issues. it's a situation in which I was just reading about, for example, the demise of the Dakota Indian Nation in the right before the Civil War in the United States, how states pushed these people, pushed them into corners, and when finally the treaties were broken and the reparation money was not paid, when they finally rebelled, when the Indians finally rebelled, the Native Americans, I should say, they were just pummeled, and then the people reacted. The cavalries went out and hunted them down, put bounties on their heads, and literally selectively pushed them into non-existence. This is the kind of thing that's going to continue to go on today. And, you know, once again, it's very clear that the American sleeping public is the cause of this. The people that are trying to figure out if they're going to vote for Romney or Obama now are the cause of this. They don't understand. They don't have a clue. And I look at people all the time in public and I go, oh, my goodness, these people vote? They can hardly make it to the next vending machine. What do they talk about? The latest prescription drug that they're taking. The state of the American people, it's so pathetic today. And there's a few people out there that, thank goodness, have woken up. And the only thing you can do in this stage of the game is just learn how to take care of yourself. Because that's the end game. That's where it's going. And the ship isn't coming back. The train's headed for the trestle that's broken, and it's going to go flying off. It's already flying off. Just a quick note on a health issue. This is called Clostridium difficile, I think is how it's pronounced, but C. diff is the abbreviation. It's a bacteria infection that is prevalent in hospitals and nursing homes and other public facilities, healthcare facilities. 30,000 people this past year died from this, equal to the number of people that died in automobile accidents. Every year, 500,000 Americans get this, primarily at the hospital or in healthcare facilities. And a lot of people get it while they're being operated on. And it's said that this could be cured. It is not necessary. Very simple precautions would cure this. And what is a hospital? A hospital is a closed environment. It could be cleaned up, and once it's cleaned up, maintained clean. But a lot of hospitals don't want to invest, so they actually cover this up. But it's apparently a very horrible condition that you get from it, mainly swelling up, sometimes as much as 10 times. And I was reading all of these stories. People went in for operations or just minor issues at the hospital and ended up dying or getting extremely sick. But just can hardly believe this. In the good old United States, it's like the meat industry. The packing meat industry, there's so much bacteria in it that in America you have to cook the meat a lot more than in many other countries. But once again, it's just a matter of cleaning up these specific facilities, and it seems like whenever it costs a dime, nothing ever gets done. The local solar report and hurricane report, I want to talk about. The hurricane season continues to be a nothing season. We still don't have any major hurricanes that have even started. Right now, just before the show, I looked at the Atlantic Ocean, and it looks like a pond in your backyard. It's just calm. There's no major storm systems. You look into the Pacific, there's a lot of rain activity that is typical of this time of year, the monsoon season there. But once again, no major storms in the Pacific. There's a little storm right now off the Baja in Mexico, but once again, you'd classify that as a tropical storm. I'm sure if you're in that area, you're getting plenty of rain. But the overall hurricane season of this year is basically a nothing year so far. That could change tomorrow. Things could heat up. But remember, this is driven by the electrical conditions from the sun. All of this is a reaction to electrical conditions on the sun. By the way, the sun is very tranquil. I just looked up today, and we are definitely in the middle of the August return current sheet. That I had a listener contact me, I believe it was in an email, and asked if I could explain what I'm always talking about, this August return current sheet. And to do this, you have to think in three dimensions. But to start out with, I'll talk in two dimensions. Imagine a flat sheet of paper, and in the middle of your paper is the sun. And coming out from the sun in all directions on your piece of paper is a stream, a wind, if you would call it, of protons and electrons. Now, that would there's an excess current of protons in the solar wind, so that means they're moving faster, there's more of them than the electrons. That leaves the sun with a net negative charge in this solar capacitor that's being built. Both electrons and the protons and the ions too, iron, basic atomic, basically atoms that are charged, ionized, are moving out along with the solar wind. But it's primarily the protons in the solar wind. And so they're moving out, and finally they get out to a point and that wind slows down, and they're holding back dust clouds that are way out, probably three times the distance to the planet Pluto, so way out there. But they're holding back kind of this nebulous donut cloud of ionized dust and gases. Okay, and by the way, that's the initial tail material when big objects come into the solar system and they first discharge the solar capacitor. That's where they originally start to discharge the solar capacitor. Once they get in towards Saturn, then start to become full-blown comets. But the point is that I'm talking about the solar wind. It's moving out. It's holding back this this nebular cloud of dust and gas. But the movement of positive charge, the excess movement of positive charge, cannot happen forever. Something has to give. And so that current can move around out there, and so it starts to drain back in towards the sun. And the most efficient way for this to happen is for it to drain back along one primary location. That location just happens to be where we move as planet Earth. It's where we move in the month of August. So the Earth is moving around the sun in its orbit, nearly circular orbit around the sun. And as we move around towards July, August, the solar wind typically is coming from the sun moving out. But now the detectors on spacecraft go down to zero. And that's just so strange to see astronomers and space scientists. They don't correlate this. How could you have zero solar wind? Well, the reason is the detectors are pointed towards the sun, and the stream, that is this counter stream, the August return current sheet, in other words, it's like a broad river of charged particles that come streaming back towards the sun. So when we pass through that, the solar wind actually reverses, and when that happens, that turns out to be the peak of our aurora month. It turns out to be the peak of the tornado month, or the tornado season, the aurora season, the tornado season, and overland severe storm season peaks in August, and then the hurricane season peaks in August. And you also find that El Nino, that heating of the Pacific Ocean, also is cyclic and heats up the center part of the Pacific Ocean. These are all related. They're all a manifestation of the same electrical power coming down from outside the planet. So at any rate, someone asked me to explain the August return current sheet. So basically, the excess current goes out. It cannot do that forever, so it has to have a return path. And now think in three dimensions. imagine the sun is out in front of you in a big ball. The solar wind is moving out in all directions. Well, the same situation applies. At some point, that charge has to move in and connect the full circuit. That's another way of looking at it. This is an electrical circuit. So if electricity is and charged particles are moving outwards in all directions away from this sphere, then eventually that part of that current has to come back towards the sun. And when it does, the most efficient way to do that is in one path coming back to the sun. And as I said, that's where Earth moves in the month of August, so the return current sheet. But back to the solar report, we have just really have not had any solar activity. We had a couple good flares a number of weeks ago. I forget the last time I was on Coast to Coast as a guest talking about solar flaring, and it was about a month ago. I believe it was about a month ago. By the way, I will be on a television program this coming week. I should say weekend, this Saturday evening, I'll be a guest with Daniel Ott on The Edge TV. So many of you probably have listened to that. It's actually on a television broadcast. But I'll be a guest for 2 hours, and so that ought to be interesting. I think we're going to cover a lot of topics on that show. So, back to the hurricane season, we just have not had what you would call a hurricane season. In fact, as you can state at this point, that as we move into the current solar cycle, we are experiencing an extremely weak solar cycle up to this date. That can all change overnight. Things can change very quickly. But as of right now, we have experienced really a nothing of a hurricane season and an extremely weak entry into the current solar cycle. Okay, I'm going to switch gears and talk about storm activity. And a lot of this material is contained in my weather book. But what I like to do on this show is expand on what's in the book and put a little more depth to it. Because the weather book, the Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun-Earth Weather, was written both for professionals and the lay public. So it's written so you can understand what's going on in the world of space science and space weather. There's a section on hurricanes, and one thing I get to do regularly is I get to talk to some of the people out there and interact with them. And so this is a result of a discussion I had this week about hurricanes and also about El Nino off in the Pacific. But I want to talk a little bit more detail about the anatomy of a hurricane. And just to review, in the weather book, I talk about the three jet streams on Earth. There's the northern and the southern. They're kind of snaking jet streams, and they wind easterly. The northern jet stream can go all the way up to the Arctic Circle and beyond, and it can swing all the way down almost to the equator. And so these swing up and down. They're like a big snaking, undulating wind current that's high up in the Earth's atmosphere. And, of course, these are part of our overall electric current sheets in the upper atmosphere, and they couple also with our magnetic field. So all of these electromagnetic effects are in the atmosphere. They're part of our atmosphere. And if there's ever a solar storm that affects these, you can actually watch a compass, you know, the compass that would tell you true north based on the geomagnetic pole of Earth. That compass can vary wildly some days when there's a lot of solar storm activity passing by. But the thing I want to concentrate on now is the central equatorial jet stream, which moves westerly. The northern and southern jet streams move east, snaking around the planet. And I know I have some good diagrams of this in the weather book. But the central equatorial jet stream rotates to the west, and it's very localized and very narrow compared to the other jet streams. But the point is that I want to describe somewhat the life of a hurricane, starting in Africa, where a storm system, a tropical storm system, is moving across Africa, moving in a westerly direction. Now, why do these storms move west? Well, there's a couple reasons. The jet stream, which drives them, is moving westerly. Why does the jet stream move westerly? Because the electrical current is in the form of electrons. And it couples with the northern and the southern hemisphere jet streams, which are primarily ions, positively charged ions. So the end result is there's a very different type of current in the equatorial jet stream in the form of electrons. Once the storm systems start connecting up to the ionosphere, now understand that the Earth's atmosphere is like a dielectric. It's like in the center of a capacitor. Let's say you take a paper capacitor. You have two thin metal film plates, and you have a piece of paper or some other type of dielectric material. It allows the capacitor to hold more charge because it prevents the electricity that's stored on the plates, the electric charge, it prevents it from migrating to the edges where it can bleed off and go to the other side. So the Earth's atmosphere is very similar. The atmosphere is just like a dielectric. It's a gaseous dielectric, but nonetheless a dielectric. So once the storm clouds that are building over Africa start reaching up high enough, it's like an electrical finger pointing up into the sky, so to speak, out of the troposphere. And all of a sudden, the electrical current from the ionosphere starts tapping into that cloud system, driving it. As this electrical connection occurs over land, over the land of Africa, there's a completed circuit that goes all the way down to ground. So that's why there's lightning. That's why the storm develops a lot of power. There's a lot of heating involved. And so the end result is that there's an electrical connection from the ionosphere through the cloud system and all the way to the ground. But what happens when this storm system, which is moving westerly, all of a sudden rolls off the western coast of Africa? Now the electrical connection, it doesn't have a ground anymore to go to. It has some shallow water that it might pass over, a continental shelf, in which case the electrical discharges can continue there, and there's a lot of water spout activity. That can also happen when the storm systems are inbound into the land, into a landmass like Florida or Cuba or the Caribbean islands. Once a well-developed hurricane moves in, you see a tremendous amount of electrical activity and a lot of water towers or water. They're like water cyclones, water spouts they're called. And you can see these far away when the hurricanes are moving by. And I've seen these out in the ocean 5-10 miles away, some of them you can see. They're very tall and very much electrically connected to the cloud system, which is connected to the ionosphere. So once these storms move out over the Atlantic, now what happens is the electrical current and the static electricity causes the air at the base, along the base of this storm system, out over the water, it starts to ionize. And so what happens? That ionized air wants to move up the central column of the hurricane, and it starts to spin. So it clears out that area by spinning, clears out the hurricane central area. Now, what makes, just one other point, when these storm systems then spin out of the equatorial region, they begin to have a life of their own. They're connected with the ionosphere individually. So I know there's a picture in my weather book that it shows five hurricanes in the Pacific or in the Atlantic Ocean all at one time. That was when Comet Lee was in the solar system, and I made a prediction that that comet would cause some severe weather. And, of course, you have to understand how to do this. There's a lot of people running around, up, jumping up and down on the Internet now, and every time there's a comet, like Comet Ellen or something, they say, oh, no, we're going to have severe weather. Well, no, you have to understand which ones will and which ones won't and how it works. But at any rate, I predicted in the previous May that there would be a significant hurricane activity. I believe it was September 6th was when I made the prediction for it. And the prediction was made back in May of that year, I believe. And all of this is written up in my weather book, all of the details of this. But at any rate, the storm systems become somewhat independently coupled to the ionosphere. And what happens? As the ions move up the central column, they rotate, something like the reverse of what happens when you pull the plug in the bathtub. The water forms a spiral and goes down the drain. Well, this is the opposite. It is moving up the drain, so to speak. And as the air, the moisture-laden air, spills over the top of the hurricane, it moves out to form the band arms and the other cloud systems that you typically see on the top of the hurricane. That's the satellite pictures you would see shows the nice, white, fluffy cloud tops. But these storm systems, and this is the point, I want to say this about three times, these storm systems are individually connected up to the ionosphere. And then there's another picture in my weather book that talks about the comet tail-like structures that form in outer space and connect to the upper ionosphere so that the water can be driven into these storm systems, energy can be driven into these storm systems, and they spin somewhat independently over the ocean. Now, as I said, there's no electrical ground for the currents to go to, so what do? The end electrical connection in the storm system is the ionized air at the surface of the ocean and at the bottom layer of the cloud system, and so that air continues to spill in from outside. I always am amazed that the energy calculations for hurricanes, the people at NOAA or at MIT or the meteorologists, they never can understand these concepts. They can never understand why the warm water theory that they believe that hurricanes are built from the warm water of oceans, why that is an absolutely absurdly ridiculous concept, because the little amount of heat that comes off of an ocean is hardly enough to drive a hurricane. It's backwards and upside down science. But they get away with it. They get a paycheck. That's the thing that I guess always amazes me, is how so many thousands and thousands of scientists can get a paycheck and be totally wrong about what they're doing. But the point is that as these storm systems spin out, now they somewhat have a life of their own. And the other point I wanted to make is to stress that the movement of these storm systems is always west. And even though they've spun out of that central equatorial jet stream and they're somewhat independent, they keep moving in a general westerly direction until they get up to a certain latitude. And then they're picked up into the northern eastward moving upper jet streams, the jet streams of the northern hemisphere. They are picked up into those, and then they ride up, they go north. There's other reasons why they can go where they go. But the primary reason why the hurricanes that are down near the equator, 5, 10 degrees off the equator, or 15 degrees, why do they move in a westerly direction? Well, it's simple electronics. if you have a magnetic field and you have currents moving in that magnetic field, there's a resulting force. Okay, so you take your hand, and this is called the right-hand rule of electromagnetism. You take your thumb and you put it in the direction of the positive current, which is up. It's vertical. And so you can do this as I'm doing it here in front of me while I'm doing the show. Take your thumb and point it upwards. That's the electrical current in the column of the hurricane. Your first finger points away from you in the northerly direction. If you were looking at this in terms of global dynamics, your first finger points away from you in along the horizontal, and that's in the direction of the magnetic field. Now, your middle finger is at a right angle to both of those, and that's pointing towards your left. And that's the direction of the force, the electromagnetic force on the current column. So you can see that that points in the direction, westerly direction, and that's the direction that the hurricanes are forced. So that's why it's really comical to see. It's not comical, but somebody is doing this. But when the mill boys get their satellites working and dragging hurricanes around, there's sometimes that they'll take an easterly path. Once we saw one that did a complete loop-de-loop up in the Atlantic Ocean. It came north of Cuba and went due north, then it went east, then it went south, then it went west again. It's just like a big loop-de-loop. And it was clearly a manipulated storm, because what they can do, now this gets into the point of weather manipulation and how it works. The satellite lasers can shine a beam down the column, the eye of the hurricane, and what happens? Well, that breaks down the dielectric of the atmosphere, breaks it down even more, and allows current to flow much more rapidly, a lot more current. And so what happens? It drives the hurricane up into a higher state. Secondly, if you take that laser beam and you move it off to the edge of the hurricane eye, then what happens? That's where the majority of electrical current will pass. And so now you can move the hurricane using a laser satellite. You can move that hurricane in any direction you want. You can just kind of like drag it around by the lip, so to speak, to move it in any direction you want. You can increase the energy in the storm if you continuously shine that laser beam down through the central eye part of the hurricane. You can move it to where you want, and you can also cause the hurricane to pick up a lot more steam, a lot more energy, because it's all driven from the electrical currents from the ionosphere. But that was a real important point, that the motion, the movement of hurricanes is partially driven by the electric fields. Now, let me talk about another factor that helps move hurricanes. The continental shelves, as you come off to the Americas, off the Atlantic Ocean or off the Gulf of Mexico, clearly in the last, last 10,000 years, just to be safe, but there was a rise in the ocean levels, 200 to 600 feet, and I'm not sure which figure is accurate. There's evidence for both, but the point is that the ocean levels rose hundreds of feet, and so that leaves us with a continental shelf. So you have a thin layer of salt water, and then maybe a continental shelf that runs for anywhere from 10 to a couple hundred miles, a number of hundred miles, the continental shelf. So what happens as the hurricane approaches land and its only end connection is the ionized air above the ocean? That changes when the hurricane moves above land. The electrical connection starts to short out to ground again. And so the effect of ionized air moving up the central column is kind of canceled out. with that operation. And so the hurricanes begin to lose momentum. They begin to lose energy. The continental shelves also help direct the hurricanes. It's very common for storms to come in along the eastern coast of Florida, swing north, and ride up right along the edge of that continental shelf that goes north, up by Carolinas, the banks of Carolina, they're called, but they're really part of the continental shelf, and then north all the way up the eastern seaboard. And that's why a lot of hurricanes ride up that coastline, is because they come in and they have two choices. They can either move inland and short out, but the current can keep driving that storm if it moves in a northerly direction and skirts that continental shelf, stays away from the continental shelf. So that's a real common path, all over by Japan, the typhoons in the Pacific. The same issue, that the storms come in and swing north and then ride up the continental shelves offside on the eastern side of the main continents. Once the hurricanes then move back out into open water, they can start to build up steam again. And of course, the other issue here is that you can have these connections that are all the way up to the ionosphere. These connections can maintain far into the frigid waters. The biggest hurricane on record, what is now known as the Perfect Storm, was a three-hurricane system, the three hurricanes combined. One came across the northern United States. I happened to be in that storm. At the time was in Minnesota, and it was called the famous Halloween Blizzard. It was something to behold. And anybody who's lived in Minnesota is used to winter. I mean, it's just part of life. It's winter that most other people would die in. But in Minnesota, it was like, okay, that's just the way it is. But this storm was a major storm. It dumped about 36 inches of snow one day with tremendous howling winds. It waited a day as we passed through the eye of that storm. And this was a major himicane. That's a term I coined to describe overland hurricanes. But it was basically an overland himicane that lasted for days. And we had one clearing, and I remember going out and buying another shovel. And I got to the store, and there was one shovel left. Everybody had gone out and purchased shovels. But at any rate, the big plows were major big trucks with plows on them were stuck in snowdrifts. It was amazing. But that was one of the three storms. Another storm came up through Appalachia. Actually did a lot of damage there and killed a lot of people because they weren't expecting it. And that storm moved up into the North Atlantic. And then the other storm was an actual hurricane out of the Caribbean that was driven up north. And these three storms joined together to form a single storm. And that's another good example of why electrical powering of these storms makes sense, because if you didn't have those electrical currents to pull themselves together with electric fields, or the magnetic fields, that's kind of like the pinch effect, where parallel currents, will pull themselves together into one current. And so those three storms, major storms, two himicanes and a hurricane, joined in the North Atlantic in extremely frigid cold waters and became the biggest hurricane on record. And no warm water up there, boys from NASA and NOAA. We've seen hurricanes on the planet Mars. There's no water there. How do hurricanes form from warm water on Mars? Well, strike three. You're out. But at any rate, that was a good example of hurricanes, and that eventually, as the himicanes moved off into the North Atlantic, they built up steam. They gained a lot of energy. And that's just another example of the interaction of Earth with outer space. Okay, I'm going to switch gears just a little bit. I'm going to talk about Hale-Bopp and a very important event in the history of Comet Hale-Bopp. Now, you all remember this comet from the mid-90s. I believe it was discovered in 1995 by amateurs. But I believe that professional astronomers, at least Tier 1 astronomers, knew about this comet. They had to have known about this comet for a long time before. When it was discovered, it was on a direct collision course with Earth, and no one at the time could have predicted that it would have altered its orbit by the amount that it did, and it missed us because of the constant tail drag. When it left the solar system, it had an orbit of about 2,500 years. I forget the exact final orbital period as Hale-Bopp left the solar system. But the important point here is that if you retrocalculate, if you look back at Hale-Bopp's orbit, that it came in and was had to have encountered Jupiter on its previous orbit in the solar system. That is about the time when I estimate that Venus, the comet, was captured by Jupiter, and that's what the ancients saw. They saw the brightening of Jupiter, and out of the brightening comes the comet Venus. The Venus that the Mayans talk about, Quetzalcoatl, that ruled the night sky for a very long time, and eventually Earth had two major encounters with Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky, and then it settled in, and its heart became the planet Venus. Venus came in and was in the plane of the planets. Venus also, we are told by the ancients very clearly, every civilization, Mars was in an orbit much closer to Earth at the time. And I've always said that really, really, there's a lot of evidence, not the least of which comes from our good, not my good friends, but the people that are the followers of Baal and the banking system, etc. The people that have the textbook on how to manipulate societies. But at any rate, Hale-Bopp was captured around that time. And once again, the NASA lie on how big the nucleus of Hale-Bopp was. The nucleus of Hale-Bopp was planet-sized. And I see I'm running out of time here. I'll have to continue the Hale-Bopp topic next week. I just want to remind you, the web page, the new calendar device is out there, and we're in about the third printing of this, or the assembling of this product. It's rather complicated if you've ordered one when you see it, but appreciate people being patient. But we should have a new supply in here any day now, and there's just a very big demand for this item. So go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, and make sure you get one. Recalendar Star Sun Clock. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.